You've heard of Grammarly, and you might think it's a fancy spell check, but people on your team have been using it and loving it for years, because it does way more than you realise. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that works seamlessly across apps and websites and can write an instant first draft in a few clicks, not a few hours. When every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, companies can save 19 days per employee per year. Learn what better writing can do for your company at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Caroline Hyde at Bloomberg's World Headquarters in New York.
And I'm Ed Ludlow in San Francisco. This is Bloomberg Technology. Three giants of global technology, Caroline. Three very disappointing earnings reports.
And will that put an end to quite the run-up in tech stocks that we've been seeing, Ed? Let's get to it. The juggernaut that is Apple. It reports its first revenue decline since 2019, falling short almost across the board product-wise.
Plus, the rally stalls, as Caroline said, in after hours with Alphabet feeling the slowdown in ad spend. We speak to the CFO.
And Amazon projects lackluster sales and slower cloud unit growth. Shares, they're also falling after hours.
Let's get straight back to Apple and bring in Julie Ask, principal analyst at Forrester Research. You look at the numbers, the sort of more deep weakness in that holiday quarter for Apple. Perhaps it was that some new products weren't released until the new year. What was your takeaway from the print?
So my takeaway I'm not a financial analyst, but certainly our expectations is that sales would be lower. If we look at our data from consumers, we have 71% of consumers today in the United States that are concerned about the general state of the economy. Those numbers are even higher in Europe. We have 38% of consumers who are cutting back spending on non-essential goods. And while we did have a holiday forecast that was up in the United States 6.1% in 2022 over 2021, a lot of that was still fueled by inflation. So savings rates are down. There's a lot of economic concerns that consumers have today. So that's one of the factors that's impacting the near term.
And talk to us about whether really this is a focus on services that will eventually bear fruit in that respect overall, Julie, because we have, despite some of the misses that we're seeing compared to analyst expectations, the CEO, Tim Cook, the CFO, really trying to talk about the strength, the resilience, the amount of 2 billion products in people's hands, the fact that services are at a record revenue rate. Is that something to be optimistic about?
I think there's absolutely it's something they should be optimistic about, because one of the other long-term factors we haven't talked about is very intentionally Apple, like other smartphone manufacturers, right? These smartphones is their number one source of revenue, are intentionally building devices that consumers can keep for longer, right? There's more focus on sustainability. There's more focus on a consumer's right to repair the device. They're supporting devices for longer periods of time. So as we focus on some of these environmental factors, as we look into the future, consumers are going to have also slower upgrade times. So Apple will have to look to building out an ecosystem of products and being more focused on their services revenue, which granted is a smaller proportion of their overall revenue, but certainly their highest margin business.
Julie, I want to go back to this idea of new products and timing, right? We write in our Bloomberg News story that it's a tough comparison because in the holiday quarter of 2021, Apple had come out with a new line of MacBooks. They didn't do that in 2022. How dependent is Apple on churning out generation after generation of new hardware to drive that sales growth, to drive the interest?
Absolutely, they are. Not only looking at, let's say, the MacBook cycle, whether it's the tablet cycle, and most importantly, the smartphone cycle, we're in an every 6 months of one of their largest competitors, which is Samsung, which rolled out a new device yesterday. But literally, they need to have the next latest and greatest thing every year with every one of these product lines, because they've got really stiff competition coming from other geographies. And Apple has a very strong focus on its profitability. It doesn't have as big of a product line as some of its competitors can do, where they may be able to sell devices at not the same profit margins or any profit at all. So absolutely, you know, you look at factors like R&D and bringing people back to the office and innovation, like all of that is key. Absolutely, product releases, new product releases, not only keeping up, but like leapfrogging ahead of the competition with every one of these products is critical year in and year out.
And it's critical to be able to make these products, Julie. And I know you're much more focused on the consumer trends, the demand trends, rather than, say, the minutiae of supply chain over in China. But supply chain has been a real headache for Apple, particularly in the last quarter. We look at actually some of their supply chain suffering after hours, Skyworks, TSMC down, and they've been down over the year, and they're certainly falling after hours as well. From your perspective, are you hoping this is a company that can remain diversified to be able to make the product at the right run rate and get it into the hands of the customer?
Yeah, I think, you know, if you read through the quarterly reports and the annual reports, I think Apple has a very good hand on the risk factors that are in place. And I think everything, trusting what Tim Cook is saying, everything he's saying is about diversifying the supply chain and lowering the risk of being dependent on, you know, one country and one geography for so many critical components that go into their core devices. I think absolutely it's important.
We want to thank you, Forrester Research Principal Analyst Julie Osk. Fascinating across
thank
the
you.
Board in terms of all things Apple. And we've got to make the pivot now because there were so many key names, Ed. And Daniel Newman's going to join us now to dig in to the world of Alphabet, Principal Analyst over at Futurum Research. And just we had a conversation with the CFO. I'll let Ed dig into that because he really spoke to Ruth Porat. But your initial takeaway on Alphabet, the worries about perhaps cloud growth, they're really, though, trying to talk up their AI prowess, right?
Yeah, I think there was misses really across the board, and this is on adjusted down guidance. Silver lining, though, Carolyn, is I believe the Fed wants to see things break. And so if we like that dovish talk for the market, we need to first see big companies that have been running pretty successfully, even through this downturn over the last year, start to miss. And so that's the silver lining. The AI talk is a massive consideration right now. You can absolutely tell that Google is going to have to lean in to deal with what Microsoft is doing with its OpenAI commitment. The cloud business, the advertising business, every part of the company is at risk if they don't figure out a way to combat what Microsoft is doing. So this is definitely going to be part, and you saw that they even have new reporting that they're planning to start in their new the reports coming up around AI to give more clarity to their investors about how that is transpiring. So it was a tough quarter for all these big tech names, but like I said, I think the silver lining is in the fact that starting to miss is the indication that we really have maybe hit this bottoming period that people have been waiting for.
Dan, we're grateful to have you on the program and get this quick reaction. As Caroline said, I've been on the phone with CFO Ruth Porat, and you know, she framed this pretty quickly and clearly. This is a reset. We are committed to re-engineering our cost base to long-term profitable growth. That was kind of her response to the layoffs. Are you convinced by that? Is this Alphabet basically saying, okay, this is the year of discipline?
I think this is a theme across tech. I think these reduction in forces and layoffs, I think it's a moment where all the companies are taking to reset. I think throughout the pandemic, we hired the tech industry hired too aggressively. I think it was trying to meet that rapid onset of demand. And a lot of the digital transformation projects that we heard companies were doing were really more bodies being thrown at growth and revenue and demand that spiked during the pandemic. So now companies are looking at some of those hires they had to make at way over market values. They're trying to reset some of those and trying to get back to a more favorable OPEX situation, which, as we've seen, as companies have announced reduction in forces and layoffs, the market's actually favoring these decisions because these are getting back to the roots of running these businesses. And so I see this as a moment. Is it enough? I mean, the size of Google is still significantly larger than it was a year ago, even after 12,000. And that's the case with most of these tech companies. So they are reducing in force, but they're still larger than they were a year ago, as many of them did a lot of hiring. So it's a start, but if the next quarter doesn't look good, I would expect to see more.
All right, yeah, Alphabet confirming it will book a charge of $1.9 billion to $2.3 billion as a result of those layoffs. I guess the fighting talk was about AI, and I think we knew this was coming, right, Dan, that executives would be quizzed on AI. What Ruth Porat told me was basically a flex. It was basically defense saying we've been working on AI for a long time. We're excited about momentum. There's breakthroughs coming from their research team, like in language models, generative AI, a big emphasis on research, because for Alphabet, it's not yet out there in the real world. Do you expect Alphabet to become a real commercialized AI player this year?
I think anything that was behind the curtain is going to have to start to become more exposed. I think the OpenAI commitment, I think ChatGPT's popularity, and the general concerns to what this could mean for search, for instance, or workspaces, is going to force Google and Alphabet to start to reveal all of the research it's done. Now, to be clear, as you know, technology industry analysts, we are continuously impressed by what Google is capable of in the AI space. They've been inventive, they've been innovative, but they haven't necessarily done a great job of coming out in front recently and explaining how they plan to combat what others are doing. And in the case of the OpenAI, it came on very quickly, Microsoft's large commitment and investment, and now Google is in a situation where they have to be able to show the market, yes, we have a plan, we have technology, we are not going to let a chatbot or what OpenAI is doing significantly disrupt our advertising business. And that's what the market's going to want to hear, is that there isn't a big risk to that part of the business that's so critical to its long-term success.
But Dan, what is the risk to that part of the business from regulation rather than perhaps competition?
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked that question. I think the regulators across the board continue to look at Google and, of course, the disproportionate amount of ad spending. I still don't think it's the biggest challenge that regulators actually have. I still find a lot of what Apple does with its, you know, its captive app ecosystem, for instance, is a bigger issue. I mean, you see Amazon coming out with 20% growth in its advertising business right now. Like I said, you see what ChatGPT could potentially do to the everyday search that feeds so much of our ads that isn't really commerce demanded search. And you suddenly say, you know, does Google's long-term, you know, market strength, I don't know if dominance is the right word, prevail with all this new AI and technology that's coming into the marketplace? Look, regulators are going to continue to regulate. Europe will always, for instance, continue to be very tough on big technology. And of course, in the U.S., we've got leadership in the FTC that's constantly looking to regulate. Having said that, I don't think Google is its biggest focus, nor should it be. And I don't think regulators will be doing any favors to the market by harming Google, because I also think with all the Apple ID, you know, the IDFA, Apple's another scary, you know, entrant to have a really dominant opportunity in advertising, as it controls so much of the flow, as what we saw with Meta.
Well, many say Amazon's also competitive in advertising, and Amazon, of course, the juggernaut when it comes to cloud services. AWS showing some slowdown. We'll talk about that in a minute with our next guest, but talk to us about Alphabet and its cloud offering. I mean, should it be committing this much? There's another loss.
Yeah, well, the losses have narrowed, and I do believe that Google has the opportunity with its customer base, its you know, its broad user base, and it's a lot of its technologies around data that it's become part of the enterprise's larger cloud ecosystem. So in what we call the multi-cloud ecosystem, Google has been a consistent growth engine. You saw they grew at about 32% this quarter, which was right in par with Azure and, you know, faster than AWS. And I know you're going to kick over to AWS, but you got to look at AWS as an over $80 billion business. And yes, slowing to 20% is significant, but the business is so much larger than, you know, some of the other cloud providers, that I still think AWS is in a really good position. Now, back to Google. Google needs to continue to grow. It's going to have to hit an economy of scale where it can get profitable. I don't sense that making money is its biggest focus, but I think in this time of austerity, they're going to have to get there quicker than they maybe wanted to.
Future and research analyst Dan Newman digesting, breaking down a big earnings report from Alphabet. Thank you very much. Now, coming up, we've got to stick with earnings, and we're going to dive into Amazon's lackluster results. I just want to get a quick check on Qualcomm shares and how they're looking in after-hours trading. We're actually down 4% now. That's Amazon, but I'm talking about Qualcomm. The largest, there is, 2.5% lower. A pretty weak forecast. At first, it was not that much of a decline because we saw this coming, a slowdown in the smartphone market. But again, the market listening to what executives are having to say on the call, and those losses accelerating in post-market. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Oh, the earnings come thick and fast on Thursday, and Amazon was among them, of course, as well. Earnings, well, showing some lackluster forecasts coming through. We're down 3.7% immediately after hours. Slower cloud unit growth as well. AWS, which is the profit center in many ways. Let's talk to Melissa Burdick, because she's not only co-founder and president of Pack4U, which is, of course, all about making the best of your e-commerce provisions and marketing, but also a 10-year Amazon veteran. You know this business, particularly on the e-commerce side. So let's start there overall, Melissa. When you're looking at what they're offering, the macroeconomic headwinds, are they navigating it? Are they focusing enough on trimming costs and growing growth in the way you'd like to see them?
They're definitely focusing on that. I would say that they're focusing on profit at this point. Amazon is famous for, you know, changing their knobs pretty quickly, and they can go from driving growth to driving profit. And that's what they're doing now. Q4 was a really interesting kind of quarter. There was definitely a slowdown in demand. Consumers that were coming in, they were actually coming in to buy deals and discounts. And the good news is that Amazon is always known for having the greatest prices. And so that's something that was definitely going for them. But, you know, unlike in years past, Amazon in Q4 actually had more inventory. Consumers wanted to buy on deals. So they came in, they bought during Black Friday, Cyber Monday. But, you know, Amazon is really focused on, you know, cost cutting at this point, being efficient, profit margins in the face of having a lot of slower demand, consumer demand.
It's interesting, on the call, Brian Nosalsky, the CFO, is talking about the layoffs and saying this round of layoffs is over, and talking about the charges and impairments which they took. But Amazon is still kind of bloated, it seems, still a big beast. Do you expect the company to be more nimble in terms of how it kind of ebbs and flows in hiring and reduction going forward?
Absolutely. They hired 500,000 people in 2020, and they have over 1.5 million employees. So 18,000 employees is not a huge amount. And in the face of slowing growth and slowing demand, you know, it's something to think about, which is they will have to look at their bottom line.
Where do they lean into at the moment, Melissa? Where are they able, within the focus on profit, to decide to allocate cash for growth?
Well, the two businesses at Amazon that are very profitable are advertising and AWS. So those are definitely areas that they plan on continuing to invest in.
But AWS is slowing. Were you worried by that?
They're definitely both slowing. And absolutely, you know, AWS market share has dropped from 43% to 34%. They have a lot of competition with Microsoft and Google. And right now, all companies, even ours, are looking at cutting costs. And one of the first places you go to is AWS. So I think that is going to be a big challenge this year because companies are looking to cut, be efficient themselves, and that will impact AWS.
I guess my question, Melissa, is how long does AWS be the sort of bankroller of the rest of the business? Because that's the situation, right? Where Amazon has this sort of ginormous commerce business, there's the Prime subscription element, the video and content element, but it's all kind of dependent on this cash cow. You've been inside that company, you know how it operates. Do you think they'll ever change? They'll ever snap free of that business model?
I mean, the services business, Amazon has become a services business. It's over 50% of their revenue across AWS advertising and subscriptions. And so that will continue. And I think that, you know, one thing that Amazon is well known for is innovation. The thing they can't control is the demand and the cost cutting part that other people are doing. And that impacts AWS. I think advertising is a bright star. They're doing so many things there. Prime Video for the first time surpassed as Netflix is the top streaming service. Amazon talked about 100 million viewers watching Lord of the Rings. More people watching streaming means more advertising revenue to Amazon. And so that is a big star for them.
Very briefly, we touched on it with Alphabet, but the regulatory overhang, anything that worries you with Amazon?
The DOJ definitely has Amazon as a target. It's really hard to call them a monopoly with so much competition. They actually have slipping market share in AWS. But that's not to say that it's not going to be a distraction and something that they're going to have to answer. So, you know, this happened before with private label, and they had to answer to that. So it'll continue to be something that all these tech companies are dealing with. But I see less of kind of a leg to stand on.
PagView co-founder and president Melissa Burdock, thank you so much for breaking down another challenging earnings report from Amazon.
Now, it was one of the most read stories on the terminal amongst our clients, at least today, because some major hedge funds, they've been asked by U.S. regulators to review certain employees' personal mobile phones. Why? Because it's all part of this big probe that continues to mushroom of Wall Street's use of unofficial messaging platforms, basically their use of WhatsApp, to be able to do deals, broker potentially right. M&A and that sort of thing. And ultimately, we're hearing that the SEC has asked Steve Cohen's, Point72, Ken Griffin's, Citadel, right. Other firms as well. But what about the liability here? What about people's phones? What sort of data might we end up sort of unfolding here in terms of health, in terms of finance?
Well, we should say those hedge funds you named, no one's been accused of any wrongdoing, but they are literally asking them to review the devices for any transactional stuff, that business stuff that's being done on them inappropriately. That's the reality of what's playing out on Wall Street.
We've already seen the fines being exerted upon the brokerages and the actual banks. We see asset managers kind of push back at the moment. Welcome back to Bloomberg Technology. I'm Caroline Hyde in New York, and let's get you up to speed with some of the cost cuts, some of the layoffs, whether they're done or not. Bloomberg Intelligence, Poonam Goyal, I'm pleased to say, is with us. Bloomberg's tech executive editor, Tom Giles, as well. Poonam, start with you and on Amazon, because Ed talking about this reset at Alphabet, this focus on being more disciplined and on cost cuts, the layoffs. Amazon seems to be saying, look, the cost cuts, well, certainly the layoffs are done. Are they right-sizing in the way that the market wants to see?
Well, their labor is down 4% on a year-over-year basis, so they did right-size a little. Now, you can argue that could they do more? Sure, but maybe they're just waiting to see how things unfold. And remember, Amazon's a business where many parts of it are still in rapid growth mode, whether that's advertising, AWS, or even on the 3P side, where they really are growing much faster than expected, or the overall retail business, despite recent slowdown.
sorry to interrupt you, Pino. Tom, I actually want to pivot to Apple because we kind of saw this coming. You know, we knew that December would be really tough. They missed estimates basically across all products. And the market's reacting, as you'd expect, pretty negatively. But is that a surprise? I mean, we thought they'd be weak.
We saw the headlines out of China. We knew that there were going to be supply chain constraints. We saw the lockdowns and we saw the impact. And Apple is absolutely feeling it. In addition to supply chain concerns, Tim Cook talked about currency headwinds. That has to be taken into consideration. But also, remember back the saying when Clinton was running for president, it's the economy, stupid. It's the economy. The economy is hurting Apple. It's hurting demand for iPhones. The economy is affecting demand for ads on Alphabet, and the economy is affecting demand for AWS, the cloud services, at Amazon. All of those things, that's the theme running between all of these three companies today.
I love how you bring them all together and this discipline, this focus. What's interesting is overall, for Apple in particular, their supply chain headaches. Did they speak to that in any way? Have we got an idea as to whether the China issues, whether they're now trying to broaden out of just Foxconn, whether that was what was hindering some of the sales, particularly on iPhone sales?
Well, a couple of things, Caroline. Great questions. First and foremost, obviously, things have changed dramatically in China since we had the lockdowns late last year. You've seen this opening up. So you're not seeing the headlines of like of people just locked in their homes, literally not going out, not buying, and people not even being able to get to work to actually manufacture the phones. So that's changing. What isn't changing, however, is these questions about, you know, just how quickly is demand overall globally going to come back? Mm. It's not roaring back. You know, they've had to slow down their hiring. Everybody's taking different kinds of austerity measures. You know, I sort of put out a tweet about how all these companies, maybe they should be talking about, just like Zuckerberg did, that 2023 is going to be the year of austerity. You're not quite hearing it as aggressively as you heard with Meta. And remember, Meta also talked about authorizing a buyback of as much as $40 billion. Yeah. Another reason why you may not be seeing quite the rally in the stocks that you saw with Meta earlier today.
Poonam, let's go back to Amazon, but also kind of link to what Tom was talking about the broader economy. You've written about a bifurcation in trends and particularly focus on that AWS drag, right? You wanted to know about the macroeconomic environment. You wanted to know about cost-saving progressions. Well, what did you learn so far from Amazon's commentary?
Sure. I mean, the call starting as we speak, but what I've seen them say just recently on the call is that consumers are trading down. And that's obviously a concern, because when you start to see a trade down, you kind of get the first signal that the economy is softening. So there are pockets of weakness that we do need to look out for as we move forward into 2023. But overall, when I think about Amazon, Amazon's just not a 1P business. It's also a 3P business. And their third party business is very, very strong. It remains an attractive platform for new businesses and existing businesses to really get the eyeballs that they want. So it's kind of a mixed story when you think about Amazon's total GMV, where 1P may struggle a little, but 3P is still very much on fire.
3P, third party, we love the lingo. We love the fact that both of you could draw all of these juggernauts together and sort of tell us the thread across it all, which is, of course, efficiency, 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 stupid. Bloomberg Intelligence, Poonam Goyal, Bloomberg Tech Executive Editor, Tom Giles, we thank you both so much. Great expertise. Meanwhile, coming up, we're going to pivot a little bit. Let's get out of the world of earnings. Let's go back to the world of FTX, because we had an exclusive interview with the former FTX US President, Brett Harrison. What went wrong from an insider view? That's next, and this is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
It's been less than 3 months since FTX collapsed, and a former top executive is eager to get it all behind him. Former FTX US President Brett Harrison insists he didn't have a clue what Sam Bankman-Fried was up to. He sat down with Bloomberg's Sonali Basak in an exclusive interview.
There were primarily disputes that I would attribute to the growing pains of any high-growth company. You know, problems around internal communication, around structuring the company for providing better governance, especially as we were growing larger, around hiring enough, you know, developers and other senior staff that we needed to be able to accomplish many of the goals that we were seeking to accomplish. And when I would try to bring up these kinds of, you know, criticisms internally at the company, they were never met well. And at some point, you know, we truly weren't really speaking much to each other over the course of the last, you know, part of the time that I was there.
Now, you had mentioned these disputes were not just with Sam Bankman-Fried. You had mentioned these disputes were with other members of his staff, his deputies. Who else did you find those disputes with?
Yeah, you know, they were primarily with Sam, but, you know, I think many of the people around Sam really agree with him on most of the internal decisions, especially around trying to kind of grow and separate the staff. There was very much sort of a separation between the group of people who were the executives in the Bahamas, sort of around them, living together, who were making those kinds of decisions, versus the people on the U.S. side who were, you know, as I said, were systematically left out of many of those decisions.
To the extent that you believe, you know, the number of his deputies have already come up and pled guilty to some of the charges that we're seeing against FTX.
Sure.
What do you think about those charges, and do you think that there's anybody else that will be brought into them?
I'm not sure if there's going to be anybody else at this point. I do think that the charges are, they're damning, and they're truly shocking to see sort of the depths that Sam and his close associates went to try to conceal this fraud from the public and the private. And, you know, as a customer of the exchange myself, as someone who had worked extremely hard to try to build out this great business on the U.S. side, who had hired extremely talented individuals into the U.S. company to be able to accomplish those goals, it was really, really sad to see all this come to light.
Now, you had said fraud, but this is still an alleged fraud. He has not been convicted yet, although others have pled guilty. I'm wondering what you think about the go-forward path here. I mean, do you have any evidence? Are you cooperating with authorities at this time?
You know, I can't speak to whether I am or I'm not, you know, involved in the investigation. I am very happy to cooperate in any way that I can. But at this point, it's really just sort of a wait and see. You know, we're going to see if there are more details that come to light, if there are anyone else that's sort of brought in who ends up pleading guilty or not, you know, whether this case actually ends up making it to trial. It's something that I'm kind of watching and waiting and interested in the way that kind of everyone else is in the public.
Have you been in touch with Sam since you've left?
No. In fact, you know, I think we were last in touch several months before I left the company even.
Have you been in touch with any of his other deputies that you had said you had disputed with? And if you had the opportunity to talk to Sam, would you want to, and what would you say?
No to the first question. And then the second one, I think nothing. You know, I think at this point, it's best for me and for everyone, the media, the public, investors, everyone to sort of to move on from Sam and find a way path forward to be able to move forward with crypto in this industry. I think, you know, it's time to turn the page.
Brett Harrison there, former FTX US president. And Ed, it's great that Shanali is staying late to talk to us about this extraordinary conversation. And I think ultimately, Shanali, just give us your take on the fact that he is trying to turn a page. People are handing him money, not as much money as he hoped to raise, but $5 million is a lot from some interesting players. Do you think he can move on?
You know, it's interesting. As you said, it's not as much as he initially went out to raise. He started that process after leaving FTX before it had imploded. And then you look at who he raised money from, the likes of an Anthony Scaramucci, who himself felt wronged by FTX, given that Anthony Scaramucci had sold a part of his own firm to FTX Ventures. Can he move on? It's interesting. He's trying to hire former employees of FTX. He's hired about five, he said. And the road, he says he wants to move on, but how long does that take? The questions that still remain are, should he have known? He says that he was misled. He says he's kept records of how he was misled. But at the end of the day, this will take a long time. Even just the responses on Twitter, people won't feel like they can move on from FTX until they start to get their money back and they get some resolution to some of the answers that are still brewing about the situation.
Shanali, terrific interview. Just great timing around that conversation. The other big headline of the day is, according to Bloomberg sources, Silvergate is facing DOJ probes over what happened with FTX and Alameda. What do we know?
A few things. This is U.S. prosecutors in the Justice Department's fraud unit, according to Bloomberg's Tom Schoenberg. This is a criminal investigation, according to his report, and it is started fairly recently. Remember, when you look at Silvergate and its relationship with Alameda, it started in 2018. Silvergate was really the bank of choice for a lot of crypto, large crypto companies. But when you take a look here at this investigation itself, it comes off the heels of criticism from lawmakers as well to describe more of the relationship between Silvergate, FTX, and Alameda, and what Silvergate really knew about what was going on and whether they had appropriate disclosures. Remember, Silvergate is a bank here, a California-based bank, that is still using a Depression-era backstop for the way that it operates. It has short-term funding that really allows it to operate in the way it does. So it is one of the more clear links to the traditional financial system when you're looking at how the crypto industry is financed.
Shanali, what's interesting, whether or not people can move on, some people are trying to move on by the fact that prices are rallying again. They're not anywhere near their heady heights, 69,000, but still, Bitcoin, the OG, is climbing higher. We've just had some numbers out of MicroStrategy, which was once upon a time a software company and basically became a Bitcoin bet. How are we seeing these companies still suffering from last year, but looking forward?
One thing that's interesting is on the way down, so many people lost so much money last year that when you're looking at places like MicroStrategy or Coinbase or places that are linked to the crypto industry, you have an instance in where people are looking at, okay, have we bottomed? Should we get in now as prices of Bitcoin start to recover? If you're linked to Bitcoin, it's an easier way to play the industry through infrastructure than it is to really bet on other tokens and coins if you're an institutional investor. MicroStrategy is still publicly traded stock. So it's interesting. You know, we were talking about being in Miami and seeing a lot of these big crypto players. I saw Scaramucci, Mike Novogratz is there as well. There is still an industry that is severely bruised, but that balance that you're talking about is giving people power to come up and say, we're surviving.
Bloomberg, Shanali Basso, terrific reporting. Thank you very much. I actually want to stick with the conversation around crypto. ARK Investment Management's Cathy Wood spoke to Bloomberg earlier about why she's sticking to her Bitcoin strategy. Have a listen.
The confidence actually was strengthened last year. Now, last year was a terrible year for everything crypto. But if you think about what happened, it was the centralized, opaque players who went bankrupt, FTX, Celsius, 3 Arrows Capital. And what did we see from Bitcoin? Bitcoin is completely decentralized and transparent. It started because of 08-09, the lack of transparency in the traditional financial services ecosystem. And I remember when we did our research, and Art Laffer, I mentioned him the first time he was on your show. He took us through what Bitcoin meant to him, and it was, wow, Art, this is a rules-based monetary, it's a rules-based digital monetary system, and it's global, and there's no human intervention. It's very disciplined. It's mathematically metered to top out at 21 million units. Well, in the last year, the responses to COVID, the fiscal and monetary responses that, you know, in many countries are causing hyperinflation and, you know, fiscal crises. We're seeing protests and riots all over the place. Well, where do these people go for an insurance policy against an implosion in their purchasing power and wealth? It is in something like Bitcoin.
Kathy Wood there. Netflix password sharing. Why are we all freaking out about it? Okay, let's get to the facts, because last year, Netflix told us more than 100 million households currently use memberships of Netflix. They don't pay for it. And they wanted to crack down on this password sharing, probably coming into effect in the end of the first quarter. That means by March. Now, why are we all freaking out right here, right now? Well, they've already been trialing ways to curtail password sharing over in Latin America, in three key countries, in fact, Peru, Chile, Costa Rica. And they put out a helpful article to tell users in those countries about some of the changes, but they published it in every single region. So that's why we're all worrying about it. So what are we seeing being trialed in those three countries? Well, the users are being asked to set a primary location for where they use Netflix on their devices. And then Netflix will track a mixture of IP addresses or device IDs, account activity, to see if anyone outside the household is using that password. And you're going to be incentivized to add members to your own household if you want them to be using it. You've got to pay up. Now, right here in the US, take a deep breath. Nothing is exactly happening at this moment. But what's clear is Netflix is going to have to use all of its storytelling skills to get you and I on board with these changes. Oh, Ed, the furor, the outrage that was across Instagram, that was across Twitter, as people got this the wrong way round, thought it was being enacted in the US immediately. And what was so ironic, I suppose, is actually Netflix had some strong news coming out on Wednesday. They wanted to talk about Netflix spatial audio, an amount of more devices if you have the premium Netflix subscription. And instead, it got drowned out by this.
We thought this would be ads, the story for Netflix, right? Ad-supported tier. But 2023 is about password sharing. And Greg Peters, before he was promoted to co-CEO, that was his project. He was out there trying to crack this problem, whether he does it or not. I mean, this was a really fascinating reaction.
It really was. And I think now we're going to have to hear from Netflix about how this might be enacted, the trials that were going on, and what it's actually going to mean for you and me eventually in the US. Remember back in 2017, they were saying it was all about password sharing. Now it's a very different matter when it comes to numbers. But talking of numbers, the earnings today, I mean, what's the after-hours reaction looking like now?
Yeah, I mean, we're still lower across all of those mega caps. And what's so interesting is we asked our audience, did you think after Meta, this was us turning the corner for tech stocks? Actually, everyone on Twitter, at least, was pretty bearish. No, this is a dead cat bounce.
Well, they're right thus far. It would seem that they're pre-improved right, although we're coming off our lows, aren't we, after hours? And so we'll go tune in to tomorrow, what exactly the numbers look like, how we perform in terms of those tech stocks. But that does it for this edition of Bloomberg Technology. Do not forget to tune in to Twitter Spaces Friday, midday. That's 12 noon, right, Ed?
Yeah, I got the crew with me and a special guest. This is Bloomberg.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Success. It's discipline. It's teamwork. It's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. And it's why Stifel is one of the fastest growing global wealth management and investment banking firms in the industry. Stifel. It's where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated. Member SIPC and NYSE.